If it please the court, I am Alexis Lehman on behalf of the plaintiff.
Okay. And I want to embarrass you by asking if you actually wrote the brief that your name is on, but I have to tell you, you have distinguished, whoever wrote the brief distinguished themselves. It may be in 22 years on this court and 10 years on the trial court, the most incomprehensible, illiterate brief I've ever seen. So it's certainly, it's not distinguishing in a good way, but it certainly stands out amongst the briefs. But go ahead with the argument.
I know that your honors are all familiar with the case, so I'm not...
Well, I'm not that familiar with it because I said it was not easy to figure out what the heck happened. What was the dollar award of damages for anything to come out of all of this? How much money did your client ultimately cover? I'm not worried about compensative versus punitive. What was the total dollar amount?
The jury award in the first case was $50,000.
What was the total dollar amount that your client ended up with after all this is over with?
$2.2 million,
that's after all the remitters?
$2.2 million, but then it was taken away by Judge Strawbridge, correct?
That's correct.
That's what I'm trying to get at. What's the total figure?
Down to what?
Based on the remitter that we accepted, it's $100,001.
$101,000?
No, $100,001.
One. As in George Washington?
Yes, George Washington.
You haven't waived your right to go back, if we were to reverse, to go back to the other damages, correct?
If there were a reversal, our argument is that the only issue would be a new trial on damages, not on liability.
All right. Were you offered the opportunity to take a new trial rather than taking the remitter? You said you agreed to the remitter. Were you offered the option of a new trial versus remitter, or did Judge Strawbridge simply say, you're getting a remitter, this is the dollar figure you're getting?
Judge Strawbridge combined that if we didn't take the remitter, we'd have to go to a new trial on liability and damages, which is why my client accepted that. And I believed that you weren't allowed to combine both.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the option that we were given. So I believe that it was in my client's best interest to take the $100,000.
Did he say why you would have to go back for a new trial on liability as opposed to damages on the remitter?
He did in his 84-page memorandum. It was the last portion of that, I believe on page 77 to 84, that he goes over the remitter as it is to defendant Winterbottom and what our option was.
Mm-hmm.
And in his very lengthy opinion, he states why the... He gives, I believe, one citing of a case law that says he's allowed to do both for us to get a new trial on liability and damages. I was going to briefly go over the facts of the case.
We know the facts of the case.
Okay. Mm-hmm. If there's no specific issues that you'd like me to address, I will try to decipher the brief that I presented.
Okay.
Why was Judge Strawbridge wrong in granting the judgment notwithstanding the verdict as to several of these situations?
I'm going to first start, because there was two trials here, I'd like to start with the first trial, if that's what you're asking. There's certain issues, number one, regarding just the first trial. Judge Strawbridge did not allow us to amend our complaint to include an additional claim of First Amendment retaliation to defendant Johnson. And our argument is that based on trial testimony that our client engaged in protected activity, that the plaintiff engaged in protected activity.
But he concluded that it would have been futile to amend because it really wasn't protected activity.
Yes, he did.
Okay. All right. I think your brief covers that.
Okay.
How about the adverse action aspect that kind of threads throughout his opinion? The instructions on adverse action were non-existent. In other words, there is no indication in the instructions as to what an adverse action really is under the law. I mean, adverse action is a significant change in employment status, such as hiring, firing, failing to promote, reassignment, significantly different responsibility, decision causes a significant change in benefits. That was not, the jury was not instructed on that, was it?
That's a no.
It was not.
It was not. If that's the trial,
so isn't that really good? Isn't that really good for you in terms of Judge Strawbridge then saying that the jury got it wrong with respect to adverse action? Because the jury had never been instructed as to what an adverse action was. What were they supposed to do? Isn't that good for you?
I'm not sure if it's good.
I'm throwing you a softball.
Yeah, it stops right in front of the plate and it just hangs there if you hit it. And you're taking a strike at it.
I guess it was good for me because the jury found it in our favor.
Exactly. I mean, for him to then say, well, you got the adverse action wrong because it wasn't an adverse action when he hadn't defined it for the jury seems strange to me. I'll bring this up with the Commonwealth for sure.
Okay. So there's multiple adverse actions. I'll take them in turn unless you have one specifically that you'd like me to address. So
I don't think my colleague is suggesting that there aren't adverse actions. The problem is the jury can't make a finding on an adverse action unless it's told under the law what an adverse action is. The jury was never told what an adverse action is. It's possible the jury would hear a legal definition of an adverse action and conclude that, well, we can use evidence about that. We're not convinced by preponderance of the evidence that there was an adverse action here. Or the jury could hear that and say, my God, here there was an adverse action, and you were the one, here they are. But how do we know that unless the jury told that?
If the jury wasn't told that, I'm not going to speculate as to how they came to that conclusion, but this is an issue that was previously decided where we proved our prima facie case, which is the plaintiff was in a protected class, he had an adverse action taken against him, and then we proved causation. This is at stages before trial even took place. So for the judge to come back now after not only one trial but the second one and say, oh, wait, you didn't have an adverse action to begin with, you already held that it was an adverse action in multiple instances.
Well, that's the difference of one pretrial that there's enough which is amazing, which is on the record, to get over that hurdle, and that doesn't necessarily mean, all that means is that if the plaintiff can establish these facts, yes, the plaintiff can make out a prima facie case. That doesn't mean the fact can be established. But the problem here is there's not enough guidance given the jury for us to determine that you did not establish this. You may well have established. Some of the juries didn't know what to do with the evidence that it heard.
Okay, well, it seems that the jury did not get the instruction on what an adverse action was. The plaintiff certainly proved that at trial. So going to the first adverse action in issue was, number one, the comments made by Defendant Braille. These were the discriminatory comments, right? The argument that defense counsel and judge...
Can I grab some water? You want to pause for a second, grab some water?
No, I'm good. The argument that both defense counsel and Judge Strawbridge make is that the comments in and of themselves didn't have any effect on the plaintiff's employment. And at trial, that was disproved. Winterbottom and Braille both fight that those comments, that he was going to be banished to the Poconos, there were some various curse words thrown in there, that he was not going to see the Poconos as long as me and Winterbottom are here, that had direct correlation to Winterbottom's decision not to place him in the King of Prussia station, which is a more advantageous and prestigious position. Braille testified that he talked to Winterbottom about the state of the Poconos station, right? We have the two different stations. And Winterbottom then says, yeah, I talked to Braille about it, and I based my decision off of Braille's assessment. So that creates the link between the comments and the adverse action. The next adverse action that is in question is the initiation, and only the initiation, of the internal affairs investigations. And Johnson, Braille, and Winterbottom, all three defendants, initiated internal affairs investigations against the plaintiff. And the crux of this argument is that Johnson himself, as well as the court, says even a pending internal affairs investigation can affect your promotion, it can affect the way that you are received in the department. It can affect the way that your supervisors see your decision-making ability. And then the court even comes in. 19J1920. We know, with respect to the decision that Captain Johnson made as to the Reading Patrol Sergeant, that it, the pending internal affairs investigation, had an impact. So that's the defendant and the court's own statement. So we've gone over the comments and the internal affairs investigation, and those are both, I believe that we've stated and that we've drawn to the trial testimony that those are both indeed adverse actions.
Had the jury known how to assess it?
The jury what?
Had the jury known how to assess that in its charge?
If we were to reverse or vacate Judge Strawbridge's order, what damages would you be entitled to?
We believe that we would be entitled to compensatory and punitive damages.
But, I mean, in what amount? Would it come back to the $2 million or?
That is up to the panel to decide. That is one of the actions under 15C, I believe.
What's your argument on that?
What?
What's your argument on that? Well, clearly, we have to decide that. But.
What would we?
Well, compensatory damages, it's the standard of what's reasonable, and then punitive damages
is
what's outrageous.
Well, I mean, they were awarded by the jury. If we say that Judge Strawbridge was wrong in overturning the jury's verdict, then is it not your position that the verdict and the amounts would be reinstated?
No, that is our position.
Okay. Well, you said something about a new trial on damages. I didn't know what you meant there.
The argument on the new trial, on having the new trial on damages, was to address what we believe is the incorrect standard that was given to us by Strawbridge, saying that in his reversal of a jury verdict, he was granting a new trial on both, and I was saying, no, you can't do that. Based on your decision to overturn the jury verdict, we're only entitled to, or we can only go back for a new trial on damages but not liability. And that was part of the remittiture argument. Are there any other specific issues that...
Did you save time for rebuttal?
I had asked for 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, then you did. Okay. That's even an easier softball question than the one that John asked you. You say yes. Okay, thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Tassar from the Attorney General's office, and obviously...
Why isn't this one mess? I mean, how can we not send this back, one, for a new trial, and two, in Judge Strawbridge's opinion, he is talking about the testimony that Mr. Holt presented on, I think, was going to compensatory damages, and he said, well, Mr. Holt testified about the economic harm of this conduct. But we didn't hear from his family members. Where is it written anywhere that a plaintiff in a case like this, his testimony alone that the jury accepted is not enough? I've never seen anything like that. It's an incredible, this is a very bright judge. I was flabbergasted when I read that. He said, well, yeah, there's evidence in the record to support the verdict, but there should have been more evidence. That's not his job, that's the jury's job.
On the general proposition of whether a plaintiff can testify about damages, I don't disagree with that, but I think from our perspective, that issue is really so far down the analytical road that it really isn't what we should be focusing on.
Well, I agree with that, but the other issue is a big problem for you, too.
Shouldn't we be focusing on what the Chief just said, which is, I mean, the jury instructions are a disaster. I mean, you didn't object to them? I can't remember. I mean, how did...
Their jury instructions...
It's assumed that there's an adverse action. It doesn't, as Judge Rendell pointed out, it doesn't define the legal standard of adverse action, and then it talks about testimony, which I read as an implication that if the jury finds that testimony credible, it necessarily follows that there was an adverse action, which is a blatantly illogical statement.
Well, apparently the charging conference and the Rule 50 argument were all mixed up together, and I have no prepared comments that I can make about the jury charge per se.
I would encourage you to read it. It's only 13 pages long, and it does not give the jury anything to go on as to what an adverse action is. on the timing issue is extremely broad. There's nothing referring to causation like cat's paw. It looks to me like everything that Judge Strawbridge just decided were things that the jury was never instructed had anything to do with their deliberations.
Are you referring to the instructions at the first trial or the second?
Both of them, but mainly the second trial.
Okay.
But both of them. It's 13 pages long from 2037 to 50.
It's as if the jury wasn't there. It's the strangest case I've ever seen. It's like a judge treated like a bench trial.
Right, exactly. But then when it came time to look at it, all these legal limitations on what was to be decided that the jury was never told. And I know this wasn't really part of the case, but as trial judges, we'd say, okay, the jury was given this instruction, the jury did this, and then somebody says, whoa, you did it wrong. Wait a minute. You didn't tell us what we were supposed to do.
Well, I can't really respond to that, although if it would be helpful to the court, I'll go back, study the instructions, and try to come up with some
comments. You'd get a headache.
Comments.
Your headache would catch fire.
Well, I wouldn't want that to happen.
I wouldn't want that to happen either.
But I think that the second stage of this, I came in here expecting to be arguing on the court's judgment as a matter of law rulings, but from what you're saying,
it's all
about that. Well, that's really serious doubts about that. I will tell you candidly, I agree with you. The case is a mess in certain ways, and it was very hard to come in late and figure it out.
Well, and that's the other thing with 13 pages of jury instructions, and it goes, and now we'll talk about the Title VII case, and now we'll talk about the equivocation, and now we'll talk about the First Amendment retaliation, and the jury's there. Yeah. So,
in any event, aside.
Yeah, we've got some more time left, but why don't we have counsel come up for a second?
We're going to call a timeout.
not like your children did. This is not a timeout for 2 minutes. This is a good timeout.
We'd like to talk to you about where this case goes.
Okay. Me?
Yes, all of you. All counsel.
Just all we had left. Before she was so rudely interrupted. Okay, 8 minutes. I'm for her argument. Who represented you, Mr. Sorrell?
Okay. Based on our off-the-record conference just now, I'm sort of jumping ahead to clarify that independent of the judgment as a matter of law rulings, the defendants moved for and the court granted a conditional new trial on various liability points and also, at the very least, on damages. The standard for granting a conditional new trial when judgment as a matter of law has been vacated in whole or in part is a tough one, but it is sometimes met. And in their brief, the plaintiff has almost not answered the new trial ruling at all. As I read it, the plaintiff's argument on the new trial ruling was just to say, well, how could it have been against the weight of the evidence? Because we offered some evidence.
What's the basis for the new trial?
Well, it is, as Ms. Lemon has pointed out, the decision is very long.
But, I mean, if he granted judgment as a matter of law, as to what's there to try?
To try, yeah.
Well, if you, as the appellate court, okay, say that the legal conclusion was incorrect,
right,
he had to make a conditional ruling on the new trial. And he went over that to say...
But you don't want a new trial, for example, when Mr. Holt appeared at the magistrate's office. You want us to agree that under Lane v. Franks, he wasn't speaking as a citizen and there's no First Amendment claim there.
On that particular issue, which we won on, I don't know that the court would assume that that would be part of the trial, but you're right. We wouldn't want to have to do that again, but if we have to do that again, we'll do that again too.
But as things stand, that's not going to happen again, right? Because that's what they're challenging appeal. They're saying that the district court wrongly held that he wasn't speaking as a citizen when he did that. Right?
No, I think they're saying that the district court wrongly refused to allow what was pled and litigated for several years as a race claim to have a First Amendment component.
Okay.
And that argument, which is addressed in our brief, is that there was no error and it has nothing to do with the subsequent instructions or anything else. That wasn't a First Amendment claim.
So that claim fails not as a matter of law, but because of timing, that it wasn't part and parcel of the case and it was too late, thrown in over the transom at the end?
I don't think the district court was particularly worried about the timing, although I believe that was an important consideration. The district court said it would be futile because the scenario would not be...
So that comes down to the law. The reason it's futile is because to make a claim under Lane, you have to be speaking as a citizen, right?
A public concern, yes.
On a matter of public concern, I'm trying to help a friend.
Right. There's probably lots of nuances that we're not going into right this minute, but yes. And that, if I could go back to the earlier comments of the court about how problematic the instructions were on adverse action and so on, that is really separate from that.
You could be speaking, the motivation, and whether or not it's a matter of public interest, I've said this in a couple of opinions, two very, very different things. You could be speaking on a matter of public concern and be motivated strictly by trying to help out a friend or by totally private interest. The biggest example is a company, taking the QTM situation, you had a medical lab, and you see for years that this company is ripping off the government on its reimbursements for laboratory tests. You don't say anything about that. And then your boss comes to you and tells you that, by the way, you got 30 days to close your desk and get out of here because my brother-in-law just moved in from Omaha and he needs your job, so you're fired. And all of a sudden you go public and you say, this laboratory I've been working for 2 years has been ripping off the federal government and billing for tests they've never conducted. That's clearly a matter of public concern, but the motivation is strictly personal.
Well, I think...
Very, very different things.
I don't really see the similarity between what you described and what we have here.
That's not... I'm saying, and I hate when lawyers say that to me, that's not this case.
It's really not.
I was just giving you an example, a very far-out example, to make the point crystal clear, but that example was not supposed to be a hypothetical for this case at all. It was just trying to take the argument to the maximum lunacy, if you will, to try to undermine the claim that if the motivation is personal, it can't be a matter of public interest. I don't think that's
the case. It says that. In people's hearts, it's another story. But that's not really the point here. And on the question of the futility and the fact that it was not protected conduct, I was going to mention that this court's decision in Green versus the Philadelphia Housing Authority arose in a somewhat similar situation where a police officer testifying in court or coming to court and so on. And what the court got to there that never was even discussed here but adds to the futility argument is the Pickering balance. And the reason why this was not going to stand up as a First Amendment claim in addition to the race claim is that it was inappropriate conduct, brought disrespect to the state police, interfered with the judicial process, and so on. The last thing I see, I am running low on time, but I did want to emphasize, in fact, that Judge Strawbridge's new trial rulings were based on, as I read it, the overwhelming, imbalance in what was brought out at court and what the jury did. And on the liability questions, but also on damages.
It wasn't what was brought out. It was on the proof that was brought out. Because he said that in terms of the damage issue, he didn't say that the claim wasn't established. So the claim was established, and the defendant, Mr. Hall, talked about the impact on his personal life, the impact on his family, but there was no corroboration from defendant members. And that struck me as really strange.
Well, I can't disagree with your personal assessment of whether it was strange or not, of course. But I think the overall discussion of the damages has to be informed by the extremely large sums that were awarded.
Yeah, that's different. I understand exactly what you're saying. You're saying it's a disproportionate finding in terms of the amount of damages. But that's not the problem I have with it. The problem I have with it is that he may have well said that, but he seemed to be motivated in large part by the fact that it was testimony from which the jury could have done what it did, but he wanted more testimony.
Well, maybe he did, but the fact is, even without the more testimony, where if Mr. Holt had testified to a greater degree on damages, it couldn't have possibly facilitated an award in his favor any larger than the huge awards that he was given, which had no basis in the record. Now, maybe Mr. Holt didn't say very much about it. Maybe that issue wasn't explored very well, but certainly didn't hold the jury back. And the jury came out with awards that were completely off the charts and, frankly, I think, could not possibly be justified for the misconduct
that's true. And I'm not saying it's true, but even if it's true, the amount of the reduction strikes me as really draconian. To move from the figure that the jury came up with, the figure that the judge came up with, and the judge's reasons for that bigger reduction seems to me to be really, to use his term, unsupportable. Maybe to knock it down some, but to knock it down that much.
Well, he had a lot of claims here.
Yes.
A lot of instances, and starting with the roll call, and there was a lot going on that the jury perceived, obviously.
Well, the jury, obviously, you're right, didn't think too much about the cast of characters here, I guess, but
sure.
That's not determinative of whether there was liability or whether the damages awards can stand up.
They may have informed them of liability. But I can see how easily that the jury could use that in terms of their assessment of whether or not they believe what Holt was saying and the impact on Holt and his family. The jury could have obviously said, well, we just don't like the way these folks are acting. And Holden Arden, he's acting in large part because of race, and it seems to me that's a really plausible argument, and it's only by a preponderance of the evidence. I see a jury saying, well, the only way to explain this is because they did what they did because the guy's black.
The amount that was awarded for requesting an internal IAED investigation on the day off incident was $725,000.
Well,
even though that request led to a relatively tiny consequence.
Well,
that's
what I said. You can see, even if you agree that a remitter may have been appropriate, the amount of the remitter, you said that the amount of the damage was pretty huge. It seems like the amount of the remitter is really hard to justify. I don't know how the judge came up with the amount that he came down to, but given what the jury, the value the jury put on it, and because the Seventh Amendment right to jury trial, it really does seem to be, in the end, like a bench trial. And the judge just kind of put his assessment of the dollar value on it, which is okay, assuming that that is some reasonable proportional response to what the jury came up with. And maybe that, when we get the 28 letters, well, maybe I'll get a better handle on it, but I'm just having trouble with
it. I'll try to explain better when I do the letter, but I think the argument that you're kind of summarizing here has a better fit with the $250,000 on the non-assignment to Schuylkill Haven mm-hmm. or Jonestown, and the fact that that is something that really it's a different position, it might have had promotion consequences and so on, that makes sense. But two IAD investigations that led to a written reprimand and a mm-hmm. one-day suspension, how can you possibly find precedent, logic, or anything else to say?
Well, there was testimony that they're very, very rare, and, you know, the jury puts themselves, you know, I don't want anybody going into internal affairs investigation of me. You know, there's a lot going on. I hear your argument, but there's a lot going on here.
Well, there is a lot going on. I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
You know, in any event, we will follow up as you requested that we do, and we'll see what happens after
that. And just sort of thank also for your candor. I don't think you've ever argued before, but just your candor and your approach to the case. Speaking of myself, we happen to—I really appreciate it. It's a big help as we try to deal with cases like this. Your candor and your approach, I really appreciate it. So thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you both.
I think these are 2 minutes, but you don't have to take. You don't have to take. But you did take 2 minutes. But you don't have to take. But you did take 2 minutes. But you don't have to take.
I'm not going to take.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very, very much. Your last statement is one which I cannot disagree with. Okay.